Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to SU Screen Talk Radio, the only weekly hour-long show dedicated exclusively to both the working and aspiring writer. I'm Chris Wainer, your host, along with Devin Watson. Every week, we'll be discussing screenwriting, movies, and sometimes Hollywood itself. Every week, we'll have a special guest, and we'll debate weekly screenwriting topics of interest to you, the screenwriter. Finally, feel free to call in. Our call-in number is 646-716-5193. That's 646-716-5193. And Devin, it occurred to you and I that in the first two shows, we have yet to take a caller, even though we've had some. So it's kind of like, call in, but never mind, we won't take your call.
Yeah, I guess we better have at least one tonight.
So those of you, and we haven't, you know, we got a few dozen listeners, you know, and I've had people already tell me, this is stupid, you're not really on the airwaves, you're just on the internet. And we're like, hey, everyone's got to start somewhere. I mean, no one in the right mind would give you and I a real show, so we have to start here on Blog Talk Radio, which actually, no disrespect, I think is pretty cool. And you know, if anything, we can be narcissistic and we can kind of pat ourselves in the back and say, look, we got to talk to each other for an hour.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is almost, you know, the only time of the week I get to talk to you, so.
That's true. Yeah, Dev and I aren't really friends, but we do show up once a week and actually talk to each other on the air for an hour. That's why sometimes it's kind of hostile. People last week were like, boy, you're kind of brutal to Devin, but, you know, he deserves it because he's got a movie coming out and I don't, so. I can be mean to you, but anyway. So anyone out there listening, and actually we've got some people who are actually listening. I think 646-716-5193, and we are going to take a call. We are actually going to take a call this week, and if we don't, then well we don't. But anyways, 646-716-5193, and we had people call in last week. So anyways, Devin, how are you? It's been a week now, and we're back at it. You doing well?
Oh, I'm doing great.
You always say you're doing great. But how about next week say, well, I'm not doing so good, Chris, and then that way I can, you know, make fun of you or something.
Well, I'll go stand outside in the rain for a little while and get really soaked and get sick. You know, I'll get sick again, and I was just sick recently, so I'll just put myself right back in it, so we'll have something to talk about.
Well, we're trying to, you know, this is our third show. We're trying to work things in. We're going to be adding screenplays or script sales in. I've been talking to a couple people. I want to come on and do a quick five-minute segment. I'm going to do it myself this week, or Devin and I will, and we're going to talk about screenplay sales, things that are in development in Hollywood. We want to try to make the show as relevant as we can, talk about things that are of interest to writers. You know, obviously writers want to know what's selling. And there's lots of websites on the internet where they can pay to see that information. And we're not going to be able to cover all of them, but we're going to hit a few of the highlights and the lowlights and cover some of those script sales. And we'll be doing that tonight and in the future. And hopefully we can bring in an expert talk about script sales as well. And then also SU, Devin, we're looking at redesigning Screenwriters Utopia, and you're kind of the front runner on that. What, you know, what are we looking at as far as reworking the Utopia for writers? So I think for those of you who don't know, you know, Dev and I are from ScreenwritersUtopia.com, the original source for writers, screenwriters, and they have the largest and really the most heavily visited website for screenwriters. And it's the ultimate source. There's a lot of pretenders out there, and you know, they've all kind of stolen ideas from us and developed their own spinoffs of us. But really, we're the one, and they can do whatever they want to do. But we're not sitting pat. We've got to redevelop it, but, you know, once again, I interrupted you, but go ahead and give us a little breakdown, because you really got your hands on that project.
Yeah, arguably there's, right now there's about 150 megabytes of data driving the site right now, and what we really want to do is, it's really, at this point, it's kind of difficult to get at everything. We had so many things in there that it was just getting out of hand, so what we're trying to do with the redesign is make it more accessible, all the features accessible, and then come up with some new ones that we have in mind that make it really easy to give tools and information to aspiring and professional screenwriters, so they have what they need to get the job done. And
go ahead.
The forums, I love the fact that the forums are there. We generally try to stay out of the way with the forums and let people help each other. Occasionally, I'll jump in, and I know you have on occasion as well, to answer some questions that somebody might have. But I love the fact that it is a big community of people from all over the world that get on there and help each other out. And we want to make sure that.
And we've got tons of information on there, and people should check it out. We've got a ton of information, over 3,000 pages of content, and we also have Script Swap, where you can upload your screenplay and review one other screenplay, and you get your screenplay listed in the database, and have other writers read and react to your screenplay and give feedback. And you know, we've got 1,000 screenplays there uploaded, and we've got, you know, lots of people using that, and that's another resource that writers can use. And once again, so keep checking back with SU. It's evolving, it's changing, and we've got stuff we're working on with that. So good job with that. And we quickly want to give a quick plug to our sponsors for this show, Co-Write Script, a truly innovative screenwriting contest and associated with Bender Spink. Check them out at www.co-writescript.com. That's co-writescript.com. Also, Final Draft. Use what the professionals use, Final Draft. That's www.finaldraft.com. If you're not using Final Draft, well, then you're using an inferior product, finaldraft.com. All right, Devin, next segment is we like to talk about different news and notes going on in Hollywood. And, of course, the big news this past week was the Oscar nominations, the 81st Annual Academy Award nominations. Anything there strike you as interesting?
Well, the Best Supporting Actor nomination for Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight. Everybody who went to see that all unanimously said, my God, this guy did an amazing job. Granted, it would be a posthumous Oscar. A lot of people, though, thought he would get a Golden Globe, but he wouldn't get an Oscar for this part, but I don't know. At this point, it could go either way. I can really see him getting one posthumously, and I feel sorry for everyone else in that category that has to go up against him.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think there's any way he doesn't he doesn't win that. Just out of the fact that it was a mesmerizing performance, but also the fact, like you said, that he unfortunately passed away, and great story, a great script. And I think that you know, he had a lot of material to work with there, and he certainly, of course, took it to new heights. And yeah, I totally agree with that. And so the Best Picture nominees that came out this week: The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Frost Nixon, Milk, The Reader, and Slumdog Millionaire. Now, did you see the news story about Slumdog Millionaire back home? Were they, you know, was it based, was it India or?
It was India, yes.
They're not real happy about it. They think it incorrectly portrays the so-called slum area that where the story takes place. So there's a lot of vocal, I don't want to say almost outrage, but not a lot of love there for the filmmakers back in India over Slumdog Millionaire. And I don't really care for the movie myself. I would much rather see Frost Nixon or The Curious Case of Benjamin Button a win personally, but who were the actor or actress nominees that kind of stood out for you?
Well, let's see. I did like Brad Pitt's portrayal of in Benjamin Button. The only thing about that, though, it's got pretty much across the board nominations. I was a little disappointed in the movie itself. Mainly, I'm a big fan of David Fincher. I love his work. But stylistically, this was really different from everything else he had done. And I share the sentiment of a lot of people who watched and said, the first half of the movie was awesome, and then it just dropped right off. And it was boring at that point. I mean, they said, we could have just done the first half and ended it, and that would have been it. And
yeah.
Given its runtime, it's got a pretty long runtime to it. it could have been shaved down and probably made even better. But I wasn't in charge, so I can't do that. If it got it, it got it. It's great. I'm seeing, Slumdog Millionaire. I can see the kind of outrage because it does. It shows really kind of the underside of things that is most people don't want to have shown. Is like, if it's, how would you like to see the ghettos of your town portrayed?
Right. Well, do any of these? What can we tell writers though? I mean, obviously, when we go into a movie theater, I think as writers, we're very. I don't know if it's for you, but I think a lot of writers will relate to this. When I go into a movie theater, I don't go to a lot of movies anymore. When I go in there, I get this, the back of my neck, the hair stands up back of my neck. I have this tingly sensation because it's just, you start to drift mentally towards that spot where, God, what if, someday I wrote something that could be shown in a theater, That's one of those motivations that's very difficult. I think it's almost painful as a writer to go to a movie theater because it's, especially when you see crap and you know you could do better and you just yearn for that day when your writing can be on screen. We have The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. That's an adaptation. Frost Nixon, Milk, The Reader, and of course, Slumdog Millionaire. Anything there for writers to look at and maybe see, here's a good example of great screenwriting, do you think? I don't know.
Well,
like you said, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button kind of fades and I'm not a big fan of Slumdog. To me, my film is The Wrestler. Darren Aronofsky, I think, did a brilliant job with that. And, of course, I'm a big fan of Mickey Rourke. But, go ahead. I interrupt Evan a lot. You'll find out.
Well, one of the reasons why I did finally, after watching so many movies throughout my life, I was very sick as a child. So a lot of what I had exposure to was books and movies and computers. So after a while, it started clicking in my head. I said, I can do better than what's going up there right now. And finally, I posed the challenge to myself, why not? And I think a lot of people do come from that want to get into screenwriting. They say, man, look at this crap up here. I know I can do better than this. And it's a pretty powerful motivation to want to get up there and put yourself out on paper because you do a lot of that when you write a screenplay, there is some personal self that you put into it in some area. So,
and that personal side, like you said, is the personal side. And of course, our special guest tonight, William M. Akers, is going to talk about how writers need to be very realistic with their stories and their screenwriting and their craft. And it is very personal. Like you said, it's tough to take criticism. And it's tough to be critical of your own writing.
Mm-hmm. Although sometimes you'll find some writers are very brutal with themselves. They will not show their scripts off because they don't think they're good. They'll end up throwing whole drafts in the can or shredder or whatever, and just totally. Erasing them because they don't like
and that's
them.
That's not just the average Joe writers, professional writers. I remember when I interviewed Scott Frank for Creative Screenwriting Magazine years ago when The Minority Report was coming out. He literally, his agent has to literally sometimes rip that script out of his hands or insist that Scott delivers his writing because Scott Frank is very self-critical. That's the important part of it is the writers who, of course, think everything they write's brilliant. They give it to mom agrees, their best friend agrees, like they're experts, and they can't have that critical eye. And like you said, sometimes it goes too far where they think everything they write sucks. And
right. The other end
is having that balance.
Yeah, and going to the other end of the spectrum, it's good to be critical of your work. Because you never know, it helps you find holes in your plot and it helps you further develop the story into something that's a little more solid and something that's a little more bulletproof, but you can take it to an extreme and it'll never see the light of day then. Scripts, like just about any other written work, are abandoned. They're never finished, but the minute you accept that, the better off you're going to be.
All right, so let's do you and I agreed to do a little contest here. What for best picture? What's your pick?
Oh, well, let's take a look here. I'm thinking Slumdog Millionaire might take it. The Reader, maybe. Of course, we have two historical dramas, Frost Nixon and Milk, in the mix as well. And
so basically, what I'm asking is, not that who you'd want to win, because I don't have two different opinions, but who do you think's going to win?
I think Slumdog Millionaire is probably going to do it.
Slum. I agree. I don't agree that it should, but I agree that it wins for Best Picture. All right, Best Actor. The Best Actor nominees are Richard Jenkins, Visitor. And what's the next one?
Frank Langella for Frost Nixon.
Yeah, Sean Penn for Milk, Brad Pitt for The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and Mickey Rourke for The Wrestler. I know who I want to win, but I'm not sure he will, especially with his comments post Globes about Bush. But I don't know. Well, who are you picking there?
It's probably either going to be Sean Penn or Mickey Rourke. I would like to lean towards Mickey Rourke because he did turn in a really good performance in it, and I was actually quite shocked to see that he did a pretty good job.
Yeah.
And it's still amazing to watch some actors that you've seen from years ago just kind of fade out into non-existence, and then all of a sudden they're back after many years, and you know they've learned their lessons and you know licked the wounds, and now he's basically the same in that same position.
So we're in agreement for Rourke. That's who we're picking.
Right, but I got a feeling that Sean Penn might edge him out. I don't know.
So right now we're in agreement. All right, so supporting actress, Amy Adams for Doubt, Penelope Cruz for Vicky Cristina Barcelona, Viola Davis for Doubt, somebody Henson.
Taraji.
Who is that?
Taraji P. Henson.
Taraji Henson. I'm illiterate, so anyone doubt that. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button and Marisa Tomei, The Wrestler. Marisa Tomei. I'm a big fan of Marisa, but I'm not sure she has a chance. Who do you like there?
Well, Marisa's already had her Oscar nod for
My Cousin Vinny.
My Cousin Vinny. Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's probably going to be Penelope Cruz or Amy Adams.
I'm definitely a fan of Penelope Cruz. Mm-hmm.
But I think that's just Penelope Cruz specifically, just because. Vicky Cristina Barcelona, you know, Woody Allen.
Right.
He usually, his female characters are usually very strong.
Okay, so you're going to go with Cruz?
Yeah.
Cruz, huh?
Cruz.
I definitely am for Cruz, but I'm going to pick, and I don't know why, but it's kind of, I'm reaching here, but I'm going to go with Amy Adams.
Okay.
Amy Adams for Doubt. And finally, we're going to ignore director because as screenwriters we could care less about the friggin' director. So we're going to go right to adapted screenplay.
Okay.
The nominees are Eric Roth and Robin Swycord. I butchered that one too. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, John Patrick Shanley, Doubt, Peter Morgan, Frost Nixon, David Hare, The Reader, Simon Boyfroy, Slumdog Millionaire. Who do you like?
Oh, I think it's probably going to be David Hare for The Reader.
David Hare, The Reader.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And why? Why is that?
Well, as the writing in it, I actually did manage to read a copy of the script, and it was, in fact, very well written. The story was quite well done, and fortunately, the production company didn't butcher it too badly.
That's a rarity.
Yeah, there's very few occasions where something like that doesn't happen. So,
okay, I'm gonna pick Peter Morgan for Frost Nixon. Call me crazy, but I'm gonna pick Peter Morgan for Frost Nixon. Okay, and finally, original screenplay. Do you have those in front of you? What are those nominees? Who are those?
We have Courtney Hunt for Frozen River, Mike Lee for Happy Go Lucky, Martin McDonagh for In Bruges, and Dustin Lance Black for Milk, and Andrew Stanton, Jim Reardon, and Peter Docter for WALL-E.
Who do you like?
Oh, tough one there. I'm probably going to have to say WALL-E is going to get it.
Wally, you're kidding me.
I
all right, so you're picking the trio though for Wally, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think you're nuts. I'm gonna go with I don't necessarily like the movie, but I think it was pretty good writing. Dustin Lance Black for Milk. I'm gonna go with those guys for Milk. I think with him for Milk, and you're gonna go with the trio. All right, so we got that, and the loser next week has to do something embarrassing. Not next week, but after the Oscars, has to do something embarrassing on live blog radio, TV.
Radio.
For you. It's not TV. Well, it's going to be TV soon, and people don't know that, but we got to keep that under the hush hush. So, all right. Well, let's take a short break, and we'll come back. We'll be rejoining here in about 30 seconds.
Shout out to every young brother, you know, just doing his bid right now. Keep your head up. Just walking that yard, wish he had wings. Just,
yeah,
you know, fly
yeah,
up out of that joint.
Yeah.
Okay, Devin. So, rejoin us back. This is Screen Talk, SU Screen Talk. I'm your host, Chris Wehner, with Devin Watson. Devin, our final topic before we get to our discussion on this week's screenwriting debate is Watchmen. You wanted to get us up to date on what's happening with the Watchmen controversy.
Well, this is actually a really long-running fight that's been going on between Fox and Warner Brothers. Basically, Warner Brothers thought they had the rights to produce a live-action version of Watchmen. About a year ago, Fox came to them and said, I don't think so. I think we've got the rights to it. What ensued, though, was Warner Brothers went ahead and put about $100 million into it and got it made and successfully finished it. Fox took them to court and said, no, we own the rights to it. The sticky part of this whole situation is that Warner Brothers bought DC Comics, which owns the rights to all these comic books. However, before Warner Brothers bought them, DC Comics sold the filmmaking rights for Watchmen to Fox, and it basically floundered. And this is back in the late 80s. So you're talking almost two decades right here.
Right.
When this finally comes around. In December, right before Christmas, a judge in court basically said, you know what, Fox, you're right. You own the rights to it. Now you guys can settle amicably, or I will decide for you. And initially, everybody thought Fox was going to deep six the entire project, which meant Warner Brothers was going to eat $100 million. Now, that can break a studio.
But that's not unusual for Warner Brothers to eat $100 million. So.
Yeah. but this was a very largely anticipated movie.
They got to get a bailout. Someone's got to get in line. They need a stimulus package and a bailout. Someone's got to get in line to Obama. Wait a minute. I heard that the thing that passed today in the Senate and Congress, I should say, Congress, House of Representatives,
just the House, yeah.
The stimulus package, it had money for Hollywood in there.
Well,
Obama taking care of his supporters because, you know, Hollywood, big Obama supporters. There's money in there, so it's coming, Warner Brothers. Don't you worry.
Well, as of January 16th, not that long ago, about 12 days ago, there was an amicable settlement because the judge essentially said, all right, this is just my ruling, how it's going to be dealt with. You guys can either settle this amicably, or you can let me figure it out for you. Both sides decided, well, we better actually figure out something here because we know we've got a hit on our hands. It's a foregone conclusion that when it gets released, it's going to make a lot of money. We got to do something about this. This all goes back to copyright. Basically, as screenwriters, it is our first duty when we finish that draft to get it copyrighted. Copyright trumps WGA registration. Time and time again. Get your form PA filled out. Make sure there is a clear chain of title when you do this.
That's a good point. Too many writers say, hey, I'm going to write, you know, Batman 5, or I'm going to write, you know, this, they're going to, or they deal with a copyright material, not realizing that, even if they wrote a brilliant script, no one would ever read it, no one would ever look at or touch it, and it would just show their ignorance and their stupidity. You have to really make sure that when you're dealing with anything that's of another source, that you have the rights before you dig into it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And then a studio does the. I mean, that's the hilarious thing.
Yeah.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah, with the armies of lawyers that they have, they could not sort out who owned the rights to this.
Well, there's a bunch of idiots.
Well, I'm sure someone probably got either reprimanded or fired for this whole mess. And the producer of the movie's career is pretty much jeopardized, too.
Yeah. Okay, quick, couple things before we do our debate of the day. Script sales of this week coming in, you know, I'm seeing a lot. First of all, it's not a lot of activity. The economy is impacting Hollywood writers. And for the aspiring writer, it's bad news because you're going to see these smaller independent companies drop by the wayside, and those are really your best option for getting your foot in the door. Now, script sale-wise, you and I noticed the A-Team. Let's go there. Story of four Iraq war veterans convicted of armed robbery who escaped from military prison and become do-gooder mercenaries. Wow. What an original concept.
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially what I grew up watching on TV, and I made the mistake of watching a couple episodes on Hulu, and now it's like, oh, man, I can't believe, well, it's entertaining for a child, but if they're trying to update this for an adult audience, I don't know if it's actually going to work.
And imagine them, four bad guys become good guys, you know, brilliant concept, brilliant idea. Who the writer, Skip Woods,
Joe Carnahan,
yeah, from, what did he write? He wrote,
Narc,
which was a great, great, great story. And then Brian Bloom, the writers on that one, and the Scott Free Company, 20th Century Fox, congratulations, that'll be a real stinker. Okay, McQueen, the story of the life of actor Steve McQueen. You ever seen The Dow of Steve?
I'm afraid I missed that one.
People, the great writing, real, I mean, just awesome development of a story without a lot of action, but character-driven, and deals with Steve McQueen, and that is far better than whatever this is going to be with Steve McQueen. I don't know, you'll never see that. I love Steve McQueen, but I would instead see The Dow of Steve, which deals with Steve McQueen in a roundabout sort of way. Another movie that is in development or a script that's sold this week, Rango. Story centers on a household pet who goes on an adventure to discover his true self. Okay. And somehow Johnny Depp's attached to that. I'm not really sure. Main Street. Story centers on a diverse group of residents of a small, economically morbid town facing the consequences of change. Sounds like America Everywhere. Oh, Tomb Raider. Gonna have another story of Tomb Raider. Lara Croft's going to be back at it in Global Mission. A Girlfriend in a Coma story. Excellent. Sounds very original. What else we got here? The story of Bonnie and Clyde. Wow. Have we seen that before? Let's see. It seems like we've seen
about three
Bonnie
or four times,
before.
I think.
Anyway, so as we can see, this is the thing, writers. In Hollywood, no one loves to be original and do things first, but they love to copy and be the second and third and fourth and fifth person to do something that works. They love to redo something that's proven winner. Bad news. All right, we're going to take a real quick short break. You're listening to Chris and Devin on Screen Talk Live, and then we got a special guest coming up here in about 5 minutes. And Devin and I here in a second will tackle a debate on the first 10 pages. What is it about the first 10 pages of a screenplay that's important?
Love and happiness. Yeah. Something that can make you do wrong, make you do right. Yeah. Love. Thank you.
something's going on. A little Al Green there. I love Al Green. Love and Happiness. Devin, first 10 pages. Tell me about it.
First 10 pages. Okay. I would actually argue maybe the first 5 pages are...
And those of you who don't know, I'm sorry, Devin. Devin's got his first feature film come out this year, The Cursed.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the final stages of its post-production and,
mm-hmm.
and CGI. So Devin knows what he's talking about. Go ahead.
Well, I believe it's important for just about any story. The first 10 pages or even the first 5 pages are probably the most critical of any part of the script you're going to have. They set the tone for the entire story that you're going to be writing. More importantly, if you're sending a script in to a reader at an agency or at a studio, their job is to, if they ask themselves this, if they read the first 5 to 10 pages and they're not in the story at all, it's getting filed in the circular bin. So that makes it even more critical right there that you grab them as hard as you can and hold them there to get their attention when you're going through those first 10 pages. I always say, I like to say, go for the jugular. Don't go for the nose because that has the connotation of explaining everything right up front. You don't want to do that, but you do want to grab somebody's attention and keep it there.
Absolutely. And what are the main, there's a few main developments that typically, and once again, we don't want writers to think page count, in the box, Sid Field, this is going to happen at page 20, this by page 80. But generally, in the first 10 pages, what are the main two or three things you have to establish?
Well, the first thing, you really got to get at least an idea of what is that big obstacle that the entire story revolves around that your characters will eventually run into and will have to overcome. Having that in there, having a problem in place, keeping a really tight pace, that really helps too. But you're also setting the tone. You don't want to have the first 10 pages be written one way and try to set a really dark mood or tone, and then all of a sudden it's happy sunshine and rainbows for the other pages afterwards.
And one thing that I think a lot of writers mistakenly assume is like page 10 is the end of your first act. You know, the whammo, the inciting incident, boom, plot point, on we go. You know, I think too many writers think, well, that first 10 pages, I got to establish all this. I got to introduce the main character. I got to introduce the antagonist. I got to have an incident. You know, not necessarily the case. The first 10 pages is, like you said, it's about setting that tone, establishing that universal rules. Where are we? Why am I here? You know, what's going on? You got to ease the audience into it. And too much, I think we see writers who are in a big hurry those first 10 pages.
Mm-hmm. And you've got enough to work with. If you're saying, okay, well, 90 to 120 pages is where you want to go, that's plenty. That actually is plenty to work with. You can probably fit more than you think in there in the first 10 pages. You're just giving them an introduction to the world that this story exists in. You don't want to cram everything up front. You don't want to go for the nose. You want to go for the throat.
Should the main character we experience as an audience member or as a reader, should that person be either the antagonist or protagonist? And if so, which one should usually or is usually the first? Obviously, once again, writers, we're not saying these are rules, but just generalities.
I like showing the antagonist first, even if I'm not actually showing all of him or her, for that matter. Just showing what problems are caused by the antagonist. You can see the effects of something and use those. And that builds up a bit of mystery. You're teasing the story out, and you're keeping the audience interested. It's like, wow, what's going on here? There's all kinds of weird stuff. And, oh, now it makes more sense because it's going along. We're past page 10. We've got the main character, the principal, protagonist in there. If you've got an ensemble, that can be a little tougher. Usually you got to pick your principal protagonist
right.
in the ensemble to basically lead, and we follow that person around.
And it's important the first 10 pages maybe, or at least the first act, to establish that main question, or you're gonna set up that third act in your first act, and sometimes in the first 10 pages is a good place to do it. And some writers use bookends where they'll start with the opening scene will be actually something that takes place later on in the story, and then they'll flash back and start telling that story from a different place. You know, and we're talking about, of course, nonlinear story writing and narratives, which I think when written well, writers can really achieve some pretty edgy and pretty dramatic storytelling when they think outside the box. Well, I want to bring in our special guest, William M. Akers. William,
I'm here.
Are you there? How are you doing?
Yes, indeed. I'm good.
Well, I want to give kind of let the audience know who you are. William, you are a professional writer. You've written a book called Your Screenplay Sucks, 100 Ways to Make It Great. And I have to tell you this. When I saw, and I remember seeing your book not too long ago, I thought, there's a genius.
Well, hardly. But
I
did come up with a good title.
Now, I have to admit, here, so many titles we see, write screenplays that sell, write screenplays that sell the Ackerman way, write great screenplays, and you chose for your title of your book, Your Screenplay Sucks. Why?
Well, most do, is the problem. I've been teaching screenwriting for a long time, and I've been writing screenplays for a long time, and I've been critiquing screenplays for people. And I found that most people make the same mistakes. And so what I did was write a checklist of things to do to your screenplay before you send it out to someone, what I call someone real, which is essentially a reader somewhere at an agency,
right,
or at a production company. And the idea is to keep people from making fatal errors that are going to stop people from reading their screenplay. Because your script is, in a way, it's a blueprint for a movie, yes, but it's really a sales tool for you. And if the reader doesn't get all the way to the end, you've wasted your time, unfortunately.
And you do, in your book, really go through, and I mean this sincerely, you've gotten some great reviews for your book, and I think your book, though the title may throw some writers for a loop, and maybe even turn some writers off who don't have the willpower to realize that they may not write brilliant first scripts. But you're absolutely right. You talk about stories and experiences. And one I liked in particular, and it kind of relates to our Devin and I's discussion about the first 10 pages, was you talked about a time you were on a plane and you watched a producer put the script down or toss it aside after 6 pages. Here's this writer,
exactly,
as you said, that spent months, and they only were able to keep that reader involved for 6 pages.
One of the things I've found for some reason, and this is true in at least all the arts that I've ever dealt with, is that, and there's a quote from Elizabeth Ashley in the book, there's no one more arrogant than a beginner, is that people that have never done this think that someone out there owes them a read because they took the time to write their screenplay. And that's
right,
not the case, and unfortunately people that aren't in the business or haven't, you know, been in meetings and been in offices, they just have no concept of the massive amount of material that the people that are doing this for a living have to contend with just to get through their week. And so they're, at one point, they're looking for something brilliant that will earn them an Academy Award, but the other, they want it to be dreck so they can put it down and start on the next one so they can finish their pile and go off and do something else. And if it's not really, 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 really fabulous, you're not going to hold their attention. And people that dash something off and think that, oh, someone in Hollywood is going to read this because they wrote it, are unfortunately wasting, you know, their time. Because what they're not going to get to do, they will not be allowed to waste the time of the reader. The reader won't finish it. Or if the reader does have to finish it and do the coverage will be, you know, not what you want, and then it'll never float up to the next level.
Right, and you talked about that entitlement mentality in the book, in terms of, just because it's not like Field of Dreams, just because you build it doesn't mean they will come. You've like you said, you've got to really be critical and be willing to write the best possible screenplay you can. Do you have any advice for writers for those first 10 pages, kind of keeping on topic to what we were talking about earlier, Devin and I? What are some of the common mistakes that you see, or suggestions you could make for a writer?
Well, it's interesting. You all had some really interesting things to say about story and character introduction, but what people sometimes don't think about much is literally the writing, the physical writing, the words on the page. And you can have, you know, you need to be able to, you need to calm the reader down, that they pick it up and you go, I know what I'm doing. I'm taking you into this world and I have total control of the medium that we're reading here. Is I know how to write, essentially. And I mean, I read stuff and by the end of literally one or two sentences, I know this guy can really, really write. And then you can also pick up a page and look at a page and know this person doesn't really know what they're doing after, you know, reading a half a paragraph. You know, too many forms of the word to be, mm-hmm. is, she is walking, she is running, the sun is shining, all that. That on, you get 15 is on page one, the reader automatically is beginning to, you know, look for the exit.
Yeah, I try
you need to spell check. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me how people don't run their spell check and think that someone is going to think they're worthy of entrusting with hundreds of millions of dollars if you can't take the time to run the spell check and get, you know, the basics right. They're not going to be very interested. I mean, it's a very, very expensive business, and because there's so much money on the line, they want to be able to feel confident that they can trust that you're not going to blow their money, or that you know what you're doing. And so grammar, spelling, just, you know, boring, mundane things like that really matter. I think one of the biggest problems in the first 10 pages is backstory, is don't tell us what happened 20 years ago. Just get us going in medias res, get the story going, and then we'll find out the details of who these guys were, you know, later, if ever. Walter Hill said the biggest problem with, you know, screenplays is this backstory, trying to get all that in the first 20 pages. Mostly, I've found, and I've done this with my own writing, is a couple of years ago wrote a script and I was having trouble with it, and I realized, oh my, I need to do what I tell everyone to do, which is throw out your first 20 pages and start on page 21 and it's right fade in and away you go. It's amazing how many scripts I critique where the story, just the wheels spin and the wheels spin, you can see the writer finally get going, and it's around page 15 to 25. All of a sudden, the power gets engaged, and we're off to the races. But a reader's not going to want to slog through 15 pages of nothing to get to your first, like, piece of story. Just, you know, cut the boring stuff.
Well, I guess, and I think you're absolutely right that times have changed, and that, you know, with the MTV generation and the internet generation and this on-demand generation and instant gratification, unfortunately, you know, writers have to get quickly into the story. I'm kind of the old school where I kind of mourn, you know, I mourn the writers of yesterday who could use, you know, subtlety, and they could ease into their stories, you know, and you know, movies like The Apartment and Rear Window and other things where you got to know the character and you got this relationship that the writer can establish with his audience. And unfortunately, I guess you're right. Today, a lot of writers couldn't
look at the opening. Look at the opening scene of the Apartment, though. I mean, the opening of The Apartment is that guy's got a gigantic problem. Is his apartment is already being used by four men higher than him in the company to go to bed with their girlfriends. The backstory to that would have been in the first draft. The four guys come along. They meet him. We meet their girlfriends. We get to know them. They come to the arrangement, and one by one, he's getting kind of edged out of his apartment. But they cut all of that out. And the movie starts with the guy being thrown out of his apartment in the middle of the night in the rain, and he finishes the first scene in the movie with a cold. I mean, they hit the ground running there. I mean, you have to – I just read the short story. I just finished it today. The movie Don't Look Now is based on. And when I was picking it up, I didn't realize that it was a short story. I thought I'd picked up a novel. But it starts off instantly. You don't know anything about who these people are, except the one essential fact is that their child died before the story opened, and that's all you know. And then they're just off to the races immediately. It's hard to do, but you need to get going, because the audience don't have the time to waste, and neither do the buyers. There's a, I don't know if it's true or not, legendarily, there is the coverage is supposedly framed at Fox because they turned down Jaws, and the coverage when they turned it down said this was written for someone with the attention span of a 16-year-old speed freak. And yeah, that's right.
Well, you've just earned my respect with your knowledge of The Apartment, certainly. You know, and you, that's a good point. I mean, even back, you know, and I guess we always kind of, you know, movie critics, today's movies are never as good as yesterday. Well, that's not really true, I guess. I mean, critics' job is to always try to find fault with the present. You said in your book, at least I'm not sure you were serious with the quote, that something about that an agent reads to the first typo. Is that
that
really
was my
true?
My agent said that. I had an agent.
I mean, I've read scripts from professional writers. If that was the case, they would have never got a job. I mean,
but the difference is. I mean, obviously, if you've got a great story and you get great characters and you've separated the dialogue and it's ripping along and it's fabulous and you just got a word spelled wrong, nobody's going to throw it down. But again.
Right.
A professional writer, he's already gotten a job. He can slack off a little bit. A guy who's trying to assault that 100-foot smooth, polished glass wall that is Hollywood, he can't afford to make any mistakes. It's got to be perfect, and it's also got to be great. So if running your spell check and taking a minute and a half to do that for a 120-page document, or 110 now, you know, go ahead and take the time to run the spell check, you know, especially in a query letter. I mean, if they get a query letter with a word misspelled, they're going to go, this person obviously doesn't care. I mean, that's the other thing, is the people that are in a position to buy your work, they've been doing this for a long time, and they have worked very, very hard to get where they're going, to where they are, and they have got a massive level of professionalism. And so they have no time, interest, or inclination to deal with people who are not professional. And I was at a writing conference last year, and one of the writers on the panel, he said, if you don't have time to get it right, I don't have time to read it.
Yeah, I would also go another step and say there's homonyms, two, and two, that...
Oh, gosh, there, and there, and just, you know, it's and it's, that drives me nuts.
Oh, it's
and it,
loose and lose. I've seen that, the misuse.
So my favorite is people injecting women into their veins. I get that one a lot. Puts the heroin into his arm, misspelled. And some readers, you know, I've talked to readers, and, you know, some of them have their own pet peeves, things they particularly get irritated about. And you don't know who's going to read it, so you don't want to give that mysterious person out there something to dislike you for. And none of this has anything to do with storytelling. This is all just basic nuts and bolts of low-end craft. You know, we're not talking about how to develop a great character, how to, you know, whatever you got to do to be a great writer. This is just like low-end stuff, and that's what stops you right at the gate, can anyway. That said, if you've got a great screenplay, you know, with it's full of misspelled words, but it's just fabulous, they're not going to care. But the trick is, you've got to, you know, you've still got to get through the door.
As well as using, I think, active versus passive verbs and not ing. I hate the use of ing.
The one that I dislike lately is makes his way, because I see that constantly. And so now I find if I write that in my own script, I immediately take it out because I'm just tired of it. And
I do that a lot.
you just need to read a lot of scripts that are well written and see what people do. And but be aware that you can. The great thing about writing is until you actually hand it to somebody, you can keep making it better and better and better. And people have a tendency, I think one of the problems, this sounds really stupid, but I really think it's part of the problem, is computers. You print something on a laser jet printer, it looks great. Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks done. And you write your first draft in pencil, it automatically looks like garbage. And so you'll go, this looks terrible, I better fix it. But you print something on a laser printer, you think, well, I'm done, this is ready to go. And the wonderful thing about writing is you rewrite it, and you rewrite it, and you fix it, and you work it, and you massage it, and you tune it, and then finally you're done. And then you give it to somebody, and then it's terrific. But the idea that I did a first draft, and it's got to be perfect, is crazy. I mean, I'm trying to think if I ever turned anything in that was first draft. I don't think so. You just work it and rewrite it and, until you finally have something good. And one thing that's difficult when you're a beginner, and this happened to me at the beginning of my career, I did not know that I could not write my way out of a hole. And so I got down in the deep, dark pit, and I thought, I'll never get out of here, and it was just despair. And then you just kind of keep writing, and then finally, eventually, you keep writing, and then you solve your problem finally. But it's hard to do. The good news is I've done it enough times now to where I have the confidence. I know if I put myself in a corner, I can get out of it.
You talked about in your book. You talked about in your book about making every scene memorable, and really, I think it's kind of you're on theme. I mean, you make good points. I mean, I guess I wouldn't have emphasize it, but our new writer has to be perfect, and every scene has to be perfect. What are some suggestions or observations you made for writers who can't seem to focus on that scene and making it memorable?
I think, you know, one thing to do is, there's some of this in my book. There's a book by Robert Olin Butler called From Where You Dream, which is about writing novels. Is I think you can be almost mechanical in your approach to it. Is you say, is I'm just going to think up more stuff, and then I'm going to think up more stuff. If you've got a scene about, you know, a guy and a girl meeting, you know, okay, they meet in a deli. You write that, they meet in a deli. Well, then you sit there and you look at that, and you just start, I like to turn the music up loud, and then just make up as much stuff as I possibly can about that meeting. What happens? Well, what else could happen? What else could happen? What's another way they could meet? Martians could attack. You know, I don't know what. Just keep making things up. And if you force yourself to just squeeze it dry after you come up with 55 different ideas for that one scene, you know, idea number 12, 19, and 53 are going to be genius, and then that's what you use, and you throw the rest away. But don't just go with your first idea. Keep making up more and more and more ideas until you come up with something that's really spectacular. And don't settle for the first three. Write 40.
And oftentimes writers will have to combine ideas to come up with that memorable idea. Combine
scenes. You say, well, this scene kind of does something and that scene kind of does something. Why don't we just mash those two together and save three pages?
Those of you who are just joining us, we're speaking with William M. Akers, author and professional writer. His book, Your Screenplay Sucks, 100 Ways to Make It Great. William, what if you had to pick, and I hate to put you in a spot, but if you had to pick one of the important things that a writer should take from your book, what would it be?
I would say one crucial thing that sometimes beginning writers don't get a handle on is separating out the characters' voices. Is you've got to be able to look at the character speaking on the page and know who's talking without seeing their little name there. Is Betty needs to sound different than Veronica, and Archie needs to sound different from Jughead, and just through their dialogue. And you don't want all your characters to sound the same, and you certainly don't want all your characters to sound like you. That's really, really important. Go ahead.
Well, I agree. I think one thing, I don't know if you've noticed, I see a lot of younger writers especially who seem to think that attitude is a substitute for character.
Mm-hmm.
They're not fleshing their characters out. There's nothing about that character that is memorable, redeeming, or even not redeeming if that's the case. I mean, but they think just because they give them a certain attitude that, well, I've developed my character.
Right. Yeah, you need to know. You don't have to. Some people write a character biography. Some people don't. Any way you get it on the page is fine, but they've got to be interesting. They've got to be somebody an actor is really going to want to play. I just saw the movie The Brave One with Jodie Foster, and there's the one cop that she has her main relationship with, and then he's got his sidekick cop who helps him. That's a minor character in that movie. He's one of the coolest, most interesting characters in that entire film. Even though he's a minor character and he's only in seven scenes or something like that, every time that guy is in there, they wrote really great dialogue for him. He's really a breath of fresh air every time he comes on, but he's just kind of a minor character who's the, like, helper policeman. And that could have been, you could have thrown that away and just had, you know, well, it was a 38, sir, And but he made that guy somebody, and it was now, really wonderful.
By voices, and you know, just kind of for the newbie writer, what do you mean by making sure that each character has its own voice? How can a writer be listening or not, you know, reading towards that critique?
Well, one thing you can do is I tell all my students to keep a constant log of dialogue that they overhear. Is just start writing down stuff that you hear. And did you hear people say in real life, overhearing someone's cell phone conversation, or you're sitting in a subway and writing in your laptop or in a restaurant or whatever, is you can, I mean, just hear amazing things that are from really real people talking. You can, you know, you can write for your cousin. You can write for someone you used to date. You can write for Humphrey Bogart. If you could write for George Costanza, and everybody knows how George Costanza talks. And so if you put
right.
George Costanza's dialogue without George's name there, you're still going to know how that sounds and his word choice and the way he's going to be. And so that everybody, almost any writer who watches television today, is going to be able to do George Costanza's voice. And so you then pick your other character, and you make your other character as different from this that one as possible, so they, you know, they have a chance to be sound different on the page. If you've got a guy speaking who's from Detroit, then have him talking to somebody who's from Selma, Alabama, for starters. You know, economics, everything plays into who they are. And one of the things that I think is very important is for writers to understand that it doesn't matter how you get the words on the page, whatever method works for you is the one that works. And so if you think something's stupid, don't tell anybody you're doing it that way. I mean, I dictate to myself. I talk to myself in the car. I write with a pencil. I write with a pen. Any way I feel like is going to get me the words finally printed on the page, I go and do. But as far as voice, you just got to practice and listen to different people talk and read all kinds of different novels or screenplays and see how they do it.
And like you said, for a writer should always be working. I mean, whether you're going to a movie or reading or you're sitting in a coffee shop, you know, you should be. One thing I think separates writers is just having that life knowledge in terms of picking up on experiences and situations and how people react and how they talk. And a writer should always be writing. Would you agree with that?
Oh, writing and reading. You need to be writing a lot of the time. You need to be reading a lot of the time. And you can read novels or poems or plays or screenplays or whatever, but you need to be reading almost as much as you're writing, because it helps so much to see how other people do it. As you're
when you watch a movie...
Hmm?
Go ahead.
As you're finding your own voice.
When you watch a movie, are you breaking it down? Do you tend to just watch it and then, you know, maybe...
I'm a sucker. I pay my money, they've got me. It's hard for me to watch a movie, certainly in a theater, and pay much attention unless it's bad. If it's bad, then
right.
I start to, you know, begin to notice the underpinnings. But when the movie's good,
then I want my freaking money back. Then I want my money back. I start thinking I've wasted an hour or 2 hours of my life, and this is what I got. But
yeah, but I'm, you know, I watch for scenes like The Brave One. I was watching that the other day, and I noticed, I thought, wow, this is a great learning tool, as I can isolate the scenes in this movie and talk about this scene and that scene just with that one character. I mean, there's a really wonderful scene in that movie, which is the scene you've seen 100 times in a movie, is the guy gets robbed, and he's at the police station, and he's describing his assailant and to the person who's doing the identikit thing and trying to figure out the police artist, which they now do it with computers.
Right.
Okay, we've seen that 100 times. Well, they, in order to make the scene memorable, I'm going back to what you said before, this kid is describing a woman. It was a woman who was a witness. He wasn't describing the assailant. He was describing a witness. And he starts talking about how hot she was. And he starts talking about her body. And, of course, the identikit police officer is a woman. And so it just makes it hilarious. And it's the same scene
yeah.
you've seen a jillion times. They just did something to it to make it different and better and more interesting, and you remember it. So I was watching
yeah.
the movie, and that leapt out at me. So, yeah, I guess I am watching with kind of my analytic brain.
Well, we've hit our time limit. William M. Akers, been our guest today. Your screenplay sucks. 100 ways to make it great. William, thank you for joining us, and we hope to talk to you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.